Hello, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again, and you're listening to Sustainability Now, a biweekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. Lake Tahoe is one of California's natural jewels, but it is under siege and increasingly awash in plastic and other wastes as visitors carelessly dispose of bottles and packages that break down into small pieces and are washed into the lake. As we've been learning lately, today microplastics are everywhere. What happens to that stuff? What are their impacts on people, animals, and nature? What can be done? My guest today is Mattia Wallner, a UC Santa Cruz PhD student in environmental science with a long interest in the problem. She is working in Professor Adina Peyton's lab and is studying microplastics and automobile tire particles in Tahoe's bottom sediments. And you can correct me if I'm wrong on any of that. But Mattia, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Thank you so much, Ronnie. What an incredible honor to be here. What a great ambiance in the studio. As I look around, I'm seeing little squids everywhere. So I'm just really happy to be here. And what a better way to, I can't think of a better way to spend a drizzly Sunday afternoon than chatting with you. So thanks for the invitation.
Well, let's begin with some background. Who are you? How did you get to UCSC? And what experiences motivated your interest in microplastics in Lake Tahoe?
Sure, yeah. So my name's Mattia Wallner. I use she, her pronouns. And I grew up in Lake Tahoe's North Shore. And growing up in that area really inspired me to be the environmentalist and the curious researcher that I am today. In fact, starting in high school, I was always the type of person who every time I went to the beach or was walking on trails, I would always leave the space better than I found it. I was constantly picking up litter and noticing litter because in an environment as beautiful as Lake Tahoe, it's so easy to see the things that are out of place, wrappers on the ground. And so it was this love of the environment and growing up in this wonderful place that inspired me to at first start a environmental focused club in high school called the Environmental Advocados. And our standout event there was a bring your own bowl to school day event. And that's where we cooked a whole lunch for the entire student body. And anyone was free to get food as long as they brought their own reusable plate or bowl from home to combat single-use plastic waste at lunch. And so that was just kind of the tip of the iceberg, the first environmentally focused thing I did. I went on then to go to Vassar College in New York State and pursue a degree in environmental studies. I got the chance to complete a senior thesis, which was a project called Mapping the Distribution of Litter in the Lake Tahoe Basin. And I got the opportunity to work hands-on with some terrestrial litter data from the League to Save Lake Tahoe. And that was a wonderful experience that set me on the route of looking at litter data in the Tahoe Basin and kind of studying it and getting really curious about that. After graduating in 2022, I started working with a local Tahoe-based nonprofit called Clean Up the Lake, and this was really, really wonderful work. So this organization deploys volunteer scuba divers to go and actually clean up lake bed, clean up litter from Tahoe's lake bed and other lakes in the Sierras. And so with that organization, I was the data management coordinator. And so I would categorize and weigh and sort and get really personal with all of the litter that we pulled out from Lake Tahoe and lakes across the Sierras. So that gave me the opportunity to work with Lake Tahoe's aquatic litter data. So I've had the chance to work with terrestrial litter data and aquatic litter data, and I really had an interest to get deeper in this, you know, the plastic pollution problem in Lake Tahoe. And so that's what drew me to Santa Cruz, to Adina Peyton's biogeochemistry lab. And the opportunity I have today is to continue this passionate work and to look at the litter problem, but down to the micro scale. So rather than looking at larger things in the environment, I'm looking at things that are a little bit smaller and using this opportunity to learn more about what happens to litter in that beautiful environment.
My recollection is some pretty big things were brought up from the lake bottom. I seem to remember washing machines and cars and things like that. But what are microplastics exactly, and how are they formed?
Sure. Yeah, so microplastics are a distinction. It's a size class of different litter types. So on the macro in the micro size, they're pieces of plastic that are between 1 micron and 5 millimeters.
How big is that?
Yeah, so 1 micron is really, really tiny. It's smaller than a human hair. In fact, a human hair is about 80 microns on average. So from 1 micron, super tiny, you can't see it, to 5 millimeters, which is something you can hold in your hand and you can see with your naked eye. But we kind of defer to the California State Water Resources Control Board definition for microplastics. They have a really great and robust definition because they include chemical additives in that definition. So in that definition, microplastics are solid polymeric particles with at least 3 dimensions greater than 1 micron and smaller than 5 millimeters, to which chemical additives or other substances have been added. And so that distinction and talking about the chemical additives is really important.
Because?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of fear about microplastics today and the way that they impact our bodies and other organisms. And I'm not a specialist in the health effects of microplastics or what those do to organisms, but from my own research and my understanding, it's the chemical additives that we should be worried about when we think about human health and organismal health.
I mean, that's like PFAs, right, which are fluorine related, right? Apparently are in everything, right? It's like they call the forever everything chemical.
Yeah, PFAS is the forever chemical.
Right. Yeah. And that has certain kinds of impacts on body chemistry and the like. So you're not do your work is essentially to document, you know, the quantities and frequencies of microplastics, or to actually do chemical analysis of what shows up.
A little bit of both. Let me tell you about the research that I'm working on. So having worked with Clean Up the Lake and having seen and dealt with that macro-sized litter that we're pulling out of Lake Tahoe's lake bed, there was another group, so Dr. Monica Arienzo with the Desert Research Institute and her graduate student, Julia Davidson, they partnered with Clean Up the Lake. And what they did is they subsampled all of the plastic litter that Clean Up the Lake removed from 5 dive sites in Lake Tahoe's East Shore. So what they did is they looked at that plastic litter, and although it looks like a red Solo cup, you know, they would take a subsample, so they would take a little chunk out of all the plastic items, and then they chemically identified all of that plastic litter from those dive sites. So they have a data set which talks about, or which shows you the polymer types, the actual polymer types for all the litter that was pulled out from that area. And so for the research that I'm currently working on, I'm really interested in understanding whether, one, if there are microplastics in Lake Tahoe's lake bed sediment. There's been one other study that took one sediment sample by Janessa Geltema with UC Davis that preliminarily looked at microplastics in Lake Tahoe's lake bed sediment, but there's still uncertainty. So number one, I want to know if there are microplastics present and to what extent, what polymers are present and how they're distributed. Really, the more important thing, and the thing that really is that makes me curious, is understanding whether lake bed litter or litter in our terrestrial environment has the propensity to break down into microplastic pollution that's ending up on the lake bed. There's a lot of uncertainty in terms of where microplastics are coming from. We know that they move through the atmosphere, that they could be deposited in creeks and lakes. But based on this work and this data set that Monica Arienzo and Julia Davidson created from the actual litter that was pulled out of those sites, I've gone back and sampled the very same sites, and I'm in the process of looking at that sediment, processing that sediment in the laboratory, isolating those particles from the sediment matrix, and ultimately I'll do chemical analysis to get the very same data set that Monica and Julia did to be able to compare the results on the macro scale to the polymer types from the micro scale to the polymer types on the macro scale.
Last year we had a chemist from Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara, as a guest. And her specialty was, her focus was on decomposition of plastics, particularly biodegradable ones. And then one of the things she said was, you know, there are these 15 or 20 different types of plastics, each of which has different, not just characteristics, but contents. Are you doing any kind of differentiation amongst the plastic that you're looking at? Does that matter?
Definitely. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that interview because I listened to that interview. That was wonderful. You had a polymer chemist on your hands. And I believe they did talk about just the plethora of polymer types that exist. So In industry, people are synthesizing new polymers all the time, which means that there's a huge repository. There's a lot of different types of polymers that constitute our everyday plastic materials. And for me, that's a really, really exciting part of all of this. So in the literature, there are many researchers who look at plastic particles and they categorize things based on morphology. So the shapes of plastics and the way they look. Some of the common morphologies are fibers and fragments and spheres. They also look at colors and sizes. Mm-hmm. And while those things are super, super important, I'm really curious about the actual polymer composition of the microparticles that are in the sediment. Okay. And so to do that, there are numerous ways that you can, there's numerous instruments that you can use to get at that chemical composition, that chemical identification of the plastic polymers. But that's what interests me. I'm curious to know what the actual polymer is and where those things are distributed.
Are different polymers subject to different degrees of, you know, breaking up, of fragmentation? Or is your interest, you know, more general in the different, you know, what kind of polymers you can find?
My interest in my research topic is certainly more general, but different plastics do behave differently. And I can tell you a little bit about the process that I use in my lab. So for the past little bit, I have been running recovery tests. So in order to test my method, the method that I use to remove the plastic particles or the particles of interest from the sedimentary matrix, in order to make sure that my method works, I have to test it a bunch. And the way that I've done that is I've created lab-generated plastic particles, so polystyrene and PVC using polymers from the Hawaii Polymer Kit, which is created by the Center for Marine Debris Research. And so in my recovery test, I'm using polystyrene, which is a lighter plastic, and PVC, which is a heavier plastic. And so based on just those density properties, they behave differently. So when I'm running these tests, I want to make sure that I float out the PVC and the polystyrene. I want to float out the more dense things and the lighter things. But this is all to say that different polymers do have different qualities. They behave differently. They fragment differently. And that's all due to the chemical additives that are added to that material, which give us the properties that we need and that we use in our everyday lives. You know, we need our plastics to be flexible or colorful or to be flame retardant. So chemical additives give a whole host of different different characteristics to plastic.
You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Mattia Wallner, a PhD student at UC Santa Cruz, who is studying microplastics and tire particles in Lake Tahoe's bottom sediment. And we were just talking about the characteristics of different flavors of plastics and polymers and how they behave differently and how you look for different things. Just a quick comment. You know, it's interesting. So these kits basically allow you to. It's sort of like a comparison. There's a term for it, which I'm sorry, I can't. You know, it's like
a control standard kit.
The control, right? The stand. Okay, and that's pretty interesting. That hadn't occurred to me that you need to do that in order to figure out what you've got in the mud.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, I can't recommend the Hawaii 1.0 polymer kit more. It's been such a fun toy to play with in the lab to have those. There's about 12 or 15 different polymer types, and it's been really helpful to be able to experiment with some of those different polymer types. It's great to have pieces of plastic that you know exactly what they are, and then you can see how they behave in your recovery method or in the laboratory method.
Do you use any other kinds of techniques to identify the polymers, like some kind of spectroscopy?
You know what? I would love to tell you about my entire method, start to finish. How does that sound?
Why don't you start by telling us how big the plastic waste problem is at Lake Tahoe? And then, I'd like to talk a little bit about the impacts and effects, and then we'll come back to...
Wonderful. Okay, let's fit it all in. There's a lot of exciting stuff to talk about. So, the Lake Tahoe Basin is a really special place because there's a lot of people who really care deeply about that environment. And because of that, they've really honed in on many of the issues that the area faces. It's a wonderful place. Many people live there year-round, and many people visit seasonally. And so plastic pollution and litter in general is a really big issue, and there's numerous organizations working on this issue. So the League to Save Lake Tahoe is one of them. They have a program called the Tahoe Blue Crew, where they have citizens and locals. They adopt hotspot areas, and they commit to cleaning those areas and documenting all of the litter and what they're finding. And so I kind of stumbled upon this data set when I was in my senior year of college at Vassar College. I remember for my senior thesis, I really wanted to do a project. I said, I have this great idea. I want to take my phone, or I want to take an iPad, and I want to walk trails, and I want to stop every time I find a piece of litter, and I want to pick it up, and I want to record what it is and where I found it.
That would be a very slow hike.
It would, right? And one of my mentors said, hey, wait, you don't have to do that. Somebody already did that. Uh-huh. They said, we have the Blue Crew data set where they've been collecting data from 2014, and they've done exactly that. So people have picked up the litter, they record what it is, and you know exactly where it is. So using that data set, using the League to Save Lake Tahoe's Blue Crew data, allowed me to create this really spectacular map, web-based map, which is, I intended it to be a tool for people to be able to reference to see what kind of litter is appearing where in the landscape, because that question was so interesting to me. I wanted to know what we're finding and where, and to see if we could figure out any of those initial trends. But so we have organizations that are working to physically remove litter from the environment, the League to Save Lake Tahoe, and then clean up the lake that I mentioned, that's removing litter from Lake Tahoe's lake bed and lakes in the Sierras. And to give you context about the size of this problem, Clean Up the Lake historically has removed about 40,000 pounds of litter from just Lake Tahoe's lake bed alone. Which is
that per year, every year, or is that
in total? In the organizational history.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. So it is a big issue. And another thing that I'll say is there was the recent Lake Tahoe Destination Stewardship Plan. And in this plan, addressing the litter problem came up several times. So it's something that people in the area are really, really working towards. But back to my master's thesis, my senior thesis at Vassar College, I wanted to share some of the findings from that project.
Sure.
So from that mapping project, we found that the top five most commonly littered items from the terrestrial data, so from you pick up from the ground in the area, were cigarette butts, plastic pieces, paper pieces, food wrappers, and glass pieces. So that gives you kind of an idea about what we were finding from the environment on land. And then because I worked with Clean Up the Lake and I had my toes dipped into the aquatic litter data, I'll share you some of the stats from what's under the surface. So Clean Up the Lake, in their 72-mile cleanup, which occurred in 2021, the most common litter items by weight were rubber tires, miscellaneous metal, and metal anchors. That makes sense because all these items are really heavy. And then the most common litter items by count were aluminum cans, glass bottles, and plastic fragments. And it's really...
I'm assuming things like anchors and tires are from decades ago, and that people are not throwing this stuff in now, except maybe at the middle of the night. I don't know. Is that true?
Correct. So, yeah. And can I share something kind of interesting with you?
Sure.
So there's another lake adjacent to Lake Tahoe, and it's in the same basin. It's called Fallen Leaf Lake. Mm-hmm. In Fallen Leaf Lake, Clean Up the Lake found so many tires, so many just rubber tires, that we believe that was used as a dumping site way mm-hmm. back in the day. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the exact statistic of tires per mile, but it was more than we had seen in any other water body in organizational history.
Hmm.
So how's that for, you know, keeping track of what people were doing in the past and looking to the litter to see the behavior of the past and present and future? It's mind-boggling.
For those of our listeners who are not as old as I am, we didn't have any way to dispose of tires. You know, they were just sort of sold, and that was the end of it, right, of any responsibility. So it was always a question of what did you do with these things. Mostly, I think they ended up in garages.
Yep. Hopefully not at the bottom of lakes.
No.
But while we're on the topic of tires, let me add something else. So in my introduction, you mentioned my interest in tire wear particles. And Well, let me tell you what tire wear particles are, and then I'll tell you what my stance on them is. So tire wear particles are, we're realizing that they're one of the most ubiquitous but underreported microplastic type in the world. And so tire wear particles are these little bits of tire that fly off of your tires due to the erosion and the friction between your tire and the road surface. And so if you picture when you're driving and making turns and braking and speeding up, there are these little tire pieces that are just flinging off into the environment. And tire wear particles are actually really dangerous. People in my field refer to them as these chemical cocktails, that tires are these chemical cocktails. And they have the ability to leach really harmful chemicals into the environment. And we found out exactly how lethal those chemicals were by looking at this landmark study in the Pacific Northwest. This paper by Tian et al. In 2022, they linked this massive coho salmon die-off with a chemical called 6-PPDQ, which is a transform product of 6-PPD, which is an antioxidant. So it's something that are put into tires so that they don't break down in the air. Scientists knew that big precipitation and runoff events were causing salmon in the area to die. They didn't know why that was until they figured out that 6-PPDQ, that transform product, was causing that mass mortality. So another reason to be really, really wary of tires and tire wear particles, and all the more reason to spend time and effort into understanding that specific type of microplastic pollution. And now, while I'm very passionate about that and I'm very interested in it, in my research, I'm actually not looking at tire wear particles in my bottom sediments. And that has to do with the fact that looking at tire wear and other materials that are so dark in color is really difficult for our spectroscopy methods to pick up.
So you don't try to sort them out, filter them out, and do you look at the stuff in situ, like in the sediment, or do you filter them out and separate them?
Yeah, let me tell you about my...
Why don't you tell us about your research?
Let me tell you about my process.
Yeah.
Let me tell you about my big headache. So people look at microplastics in different matrices, so in different things. You could look at it in clean water or storm water. I chose to look at Lake Tahoe sediment because I'm interested in that environment. But looking at microplastics in sediment is a big whole headache because you're dealing with a lot of stuff that you don't care about. So minerals, biological material, and then maybe a small, tiny portion of things that you do care about, so your particles of interest. But how do you get the particles of interest out of all the stuff that you don't care about? Well, there's a few steps. What I'm doing in my lab and what I've spent time doing in my recovery testing is taking the sediment and then adding a dense liquid to the sediment. So what I'm using is a type of salt water. I'm using calcium chloride salt water. And this causes the lighter particles to float to the surface. And so presumably plastics and particles of interest. Once I have those, well, and let me tell you another thing. I'm also getting these miraculous floating minerals. I'm getting minerals that float because of surface tension and other hydrostatic forces, but this is part of the headache. So the majority of the sediment is settling. I'm getting some pesky floating sediment. It's like the bane of my existence. So, but once I've added the heavy liquid solution, I have my particles that have floated off to the top. And then I capture those particles, and then my next step is a digestion step. So I'll take those particles and I'll treat them with hydrogen peroxide over time and applying heat. And this deteriorates the biological material, so any pieces of algae or pieces of wood that might be floating. The digestion step takes care of those. And at the end, I'm left with a filter and particles on it. And at this point, I don't know what those particles are. So the next step is that chemical analysis. And so for chemical analysis, I'm relying on a method called Raman spectroscopy. And essentially that is taking a laser and pointing a laser at these individual particles. And the laser interacts with these particles. It's infrared light that gets absorbed by these particles. And it reads out a graph, which we call spectra. And the peaks of this graph will tell you what chemical bonds are present. And based on the bonds that are present, we're able to understand the polymer type, so what the plastic is made out of.
I sort of recall doing something like that in college, or maybe it was in graduate school. But so you're really looking at the reflections from the particles. I mean, are the graphs That's not what they're called.
Yeah, you can call it a graph.
Spectra.
Yes.
The spectra, you know. Are they reflecting the molecular or mineral composition of the plastic? Because I'm assuming you're looking at now, folks, I don't want to get too complicated here, but the lasers produce resonances in the particles, right? They reflect the spectra. What is it that they're you know, is producing the peaks? That's what I want to know, is what in the particles are producing the peaks that you observe?
Definitely.
And it's not on an oscilloscope, I know, but...
Yeah, and this is getting a little bit in the weeds also, but my understanding is that you get a different vibrational mode based on the elements that are bonded together.
Right.
And so when you shoot that infrared light, some of it gets absorbed and some of it gets reflected, and then the instrument is able to pick on the type of vibration and the way that those molecular bonds are interacting.
Mm-hmm.
And then they give you a peak.
Yeah.
And that peak tells you what the bond is.
Yeah.
So there could be a CH stretch, a carbon hydrogen stretch that the instrument is picking up on, and then it will give you a peak in the CH region, in the carbon hydrogen bond region.
Okay.
And so you get a really pretty graph, and the graphs for different polymer types should look a certain way, and based on that we can tell what the polymer is.
Is there a Hawaii kit of spectra?
You know what? There is. With the kit that they sell you,
yeah,
it also comes with a memory stick that has spectral graphs for all the polymer types.
Wow. Okay.
They thought of everything.
Yeah. We didn't worry about these things in my day. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Mattio Wallner, a PhD student at UC Santa Cruz, who is doing work on microplastics in Tahoe's lake bottom sediment. And we've been just talking about some, I suppose, rather arcane chemical and spectroscopy issues in terms of identifying what kinds of plastics are in the sediments. Mattio, how do you collect this stuff? You know, what do you do with it? Tell us something about that.
Totally. Yeah, so I told you about the headache of my job, which is working in the lab and dealing with a bunch of stuff that you don't care about to get to the stuff that you do care about. But kind of the really beautiful part of my job is getting to go out to the field to do the actual sampling. And so I was really lucky on my latest sampling campaign. I went up to Tahoe in September, and I leveraged some of the connections that I had through Clean Up the Lake, and I was able to get in touch with a really wonderful volunteer scuba diver and a really incredible boat captain and his two daughters. And so we assembled a sampling team, and with their help, we went and we revisited the five transects, the five dive sites that Clean Up the Lake cleaned in 2021 that Monica Arienzo and Julia Davidson chemically analyzed all that litter.
Mm-hmm.
So we returned to those same sites, and I used a Van Veen sampler, which is like if you've ever gone to the arcade and played like the claw grab game, or if you can picture a big excavator hand, I deployed one of those, 1 liter in size, topside, so off of the boat and off of a string. And here's the thing, before going up to Tahoe, I practiced this on the wharf. So in Santa Cruz, off the wharf, my partner and I went and we deployed this grabber just to see if it would work. Well, it didn't work that well. And so I had to pivot and I had to think, okay, well, can I get a scuba diver on board who can actually physically help me underwater? So up in Tahoe, we got that scuba diver and I deployed the Van Veen sampler from the boat, and then we deployed the scuba diver underwater. And I have these really incredible videos from the GoPro on the scuba diver where he's going down and he's manually helping that claw hand close and grab the top of the sediment. So from these five sites, I sampled three different sites within those five transects. And I was removing sediment from just the top surface of the lake bed. So it wasn't a sediment core, it was just a grab sample from the top. And we were working at roughly 25 feet of depth, because that's the same depth that Clean Up the Lake cleaned in 2021. So we wanted to stay a little bit consistent there. And so those are the samples that I'm working with today in the lab. It was a really fun experience to deploy the diver and to work with the boat captain, and actually his two daughters were helping me collect data. So it was a really fun couple of days in the field with them.
I mean, in theory, if you took sediment cores, you could actually document the history of plastic deposition in the sediments, which would also be quite interesting. I mean, you wouldn't see much of anything before
1950.
Well, I was going to say 1960, but because we still had glass in the 50s. And then you take that and do what you were telling us.
Yep, you do the density separation with a salt solution and then a digestion with hydrogen peroxide and then whatever your chemical identification method is. Mm-hmm.
Have you had any results yet? I mean, what have you been finding? Have you analyzed your data?
So far I've been in the methods development and troubleshooting stage. Uh-huh. I've analyzed different particles using the Raman Raman instrument.
Yeah.
But I don't have any data back yet from my samples so far, but that'll come soon, and I'm really excited to see what we'll find. I think that we will find microplastics, and in speaking with one of my mentors, Monica Arienzo at the Desert Research Institute, she also believes that I'll find microplastic particles because they're just so ubiquitous mm-hmm. in the environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And where will all of this go? I mean, I want to talk some more about microplastics and, you know, impacts, but what will you do once you have, I know you'll write a dissertation, right? But what will you do with your findings? How do you imagine those going out into the world? And are other people doing this kind of work as well?
Yeah, I am really hoping that what I find fits in like a puzzle piece into a larger puzzle, which is trying to figure out where microplastics are coming from in the Lake Tahoe Basin. So we have wonderful folks at the University of Nevada, Reno, and at the Desert Research Institute who are looking at all different aspects of microplastic transport and fate. So we have people looking at the creeks and sampling water from the creek all the way into the lake. We've had folks look at the regional snowpack in the area to see if there are microplastics in the snow. And we've had folks look at different depth profiles in the lake itself. So the really big question and the focus of a lot of microplastic research is, A, to figure out what we have and in what numbers and the concentrations, mm-hmm. but B, to figure out where they're coming from, right? That's a really important part of this.
So this is not from the fragmentation of all of the plastic that's getting thrown away?
Well, that's part of the question, isn't it?
Well, I don't know, right? It's not. I mean, I only know what I read, online about microplastics at the top of the Himalayas.
That question has been driving my research. If I'm finding microplastic particles that are really similar to the polymers that we found from the macro litter, and if I'm seeing morphologies that look like fragments, then it could indicate a relationship between larger pieces of plastic breaking down into smaller pieces. But if I'm finding a ton of fibers and different polymer types that aren't matching that initial macro litter data set, mm-hmm. then it could indicate things are coming from the atmosphere and they're raining down or they're coming from different sources. So it's all part of this challenge of figuring out where things are coming from the best that we can.
Is this a situation in which the fish in the lake are eating these things as well? I mean, I seem to remember reading about fish at sea, you know, identifying floating plastics as food and that stuff being found in the fish.
Yeah. There have been studies. I mentioned Janessa Geltema with UC Davis. She, in her study where she looked at one sediment sample, she looked a lot more extensively at different organisms and mm-hmm. fish and found microplastic particles in fish in Lake Tahoe and other organisms, I think a filter feeder organism. But yes.
Anything else you want to add about your research methodology? So this is also not a well-developed kind of area of research, I gather, since you've had to develop your method, right? Is that accurate or?
I would say these methods are very well documented.
Yeah.
But as is the way of science, even if something has been established one place, you still have to try it out in your own lab and make sure that things are working the way they should. Yep. The practice of science is so iterative. If you read something in the literature, you can assume, well, you can't assume it works. You have to actually go out and test it. So these things do take a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a bit more about the impacts and effects of microplastics. You know, where do they turn up, and how do they get into bodies?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a question that is on the brain of so many people.
Literally.
Yeah, and it's funny because we have found microplastics in people's brains. But I want to start by saying this is something that's really interesting to me, but I am not an expert in the health effects of microplastics.
And that's probably okay, because if we had an expert, we wouldn't understand it.
Well, we would hope to understand
it. We would hope, but...
So my understanding is that we are eating plastics at the micro and nano scale all the time. And my understanding is that the positive is that we excrete the majority of those particles that we consume. It's just when we talk about the smaller size class, so the nano size class, that things get a little bit dicey. So that's when we talk about translocation, which is the idea that these nanoplastics are moving through different compartments of the body.
What is that in comparison to the micron-sized? When you use the term nano, I don't know if everyone's familiar with it. What size is nano in comparison to a human hair?
Yeah, the nano size is less than 1 micron. And again, a human hair is about 80 microns.
Okay, so it's basically what you've been talking about in terms of the range that you're looking at. Right?
Yeah, so the nanoscale is less than 1 micron, very, very tiny. Mm-hmm. And it's the size that allows those things, to my understanding, to translocate, so to move through different compartments of the body. Mm-hmm. But as I mentioned previously, it's the chemical additives that are a little bit concerning. So some of these chemical additives can be endocrine disrupting. That means they mess with an organism's reproductive and hormonal system. They can also be carcinogenic, which means with exposure and time, they can create cancer. And then in some cases, they can be acutely toxic or lethal. And that's the case of the coho salmon in the Pacific Northwest, where when they were exposed to 6 PPDQ, they died. And so I'm not sure. I think more research needs to be done to understand the long-term effects of microplastics in the human body. And a lot of research is going in to understand the effect of micro and nanoplastics in different organisms.
Mm-hmm. Where do they? And do you have any information about where this stuff turns up in the human body?
I've looked at studies where they mention they're finding microplastics in people's brains. So they're crossing the blood-brain barrier. And that means that the particles are very tiny to be able to pass through a membrane like that. And then people are finding microplastics in different reproductive organs in humans. But again, I'm not an expert. I did read a study where they were looking at brains of people who were deceased who had Alzheimer's, and they pointed to an increase in microplastics and nanoplastics in the brains of people who did have that disease. But this is a really new field, and there's a lot of work being done to understand the effects of these chemicals and the particles themselves in the human body.
Well, Mattia, we have about 15 minutes left together. What else would you like to talk about?
I'd love to talk to you about the things that are being done in the Lake Tahoe Basin to address the issue of microplastic pollution. And so I'm really excited to tell you about a very recent study that was published in September of this year by Monica Arienzo and her group at the Desert Research Institute. So they were really interested in figuring out whether household dryers are a potential source for microplastic pollution, namely fibers. So fibers are one of the morphologies that we see a lot of in the realm of microplastics. And so for this study, they employed some volunteers in the basin to attach filters to the dryer output, so the dryer vent on the side of the house, because normally that stuff is just ejected into the environment.
Right.
So they had households volunteer for this dryer study, and they collected those samples, and they found some really, really interesting findings. So based on the findings from these select few households, they were able to extrapolate for the entire U.S. population, and they estimated that there's about 3,500 metric tons of microfibers that are discharged each year in the U.S. alone. And so what is that number? That's about 30 times the weight of the Statue of Liberty. And this is for the entire United States. But of that number, so of that 3,500 metric tons, they estimate that just under 3,000 metric tons are from natural fabrics, so cottons and whatnot, while 460 metric tons are from synthetic fabrics. So about 1/7 of that entire pollution load is synthetic microfibers, microplastic fibers. But this is a really great example of how understanding more about this issue will allow us to make changes in the future. So it's really likely that the more we learn about how the dryers that are in our homes that might be a source of pollution, if we understand that, then we can take action to change that. And I'm just very proud to be part of this community in Lake Tahoe because so much is going on to understand these issues and to employ people in the community to help solve these problems and to learn more about this pollution. So there's a lot of really exciting things happening in the Tahoe Basin with regard to microplastic pollution research.
You said you wanted to talk about plastics in the ocean too.
Yeah. Something that I really want you and the listeners of this show to understand is really the gravity of the problem. So what's the substance of this issue? The substance is the scale. So there's a really prominent researcher named Roland Geyer, and in a 2020 publication, he said that by 2050, we will have produced 34 billion tons of new plastic from fossil fuel feedstock. So this is to say that we are creating new plastic items, and we are continuing to do so at a really incredible rate. And with the increase in plastic production, there's an increase in the amount of mismanaged plastic waste. And so another really prominent researcher in this field is Anthony Andrade. And in his 2022 book titled Plastics and the Ocean, he gave a stat that has just really sat on my heart for weeks and weeks and months and months. And that statistic is that plastic waste enters the ocean at a rate of about one garbage truck load a minute, that will increase to about four garbage truck loads per minute by 2050. So not only are we making more plastic things, making more brand new plastic things, but we're also adding up to four garbage truck loads of plastic waste directly into the ocean. And so this is plastic that is entering rivers and streams and lakes and eventually moving into the ocean, which is the ultimate sink. Essentially, all of the plastic that we create that we don't incinerate or bury will end up at the seafloor. And so with these statistics, I hope you really understand the gravity of this issue and why it's so important to study.
The availability of fossil fuels, right? I mean, if the price of the feedstock were more expensive, there would be more incentives to use less, right? What's happening is there are more searching going on for new sources of fossil fuel, right? So the low price actually facilitates the production of more plastic. And the other thing is, of course, if we reduced our consumption of fossil fuels, that would even increase the raw materials sources more.
That's correct. It sounds like you've done your research.
Well, I've been, you know, studying this kind of stuff for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, it's a hard issue, and it's something that also hinders our efforts for recycling. So it's cheaper for producers to buy raw resin from new fossil fuels to make their plastic items than it is to buy recycled or used or post-consumer goods. It's literally cheaper just to make new things out of new resin than it is to make things out of recycled plastic, which is why it's so, so difficult to get plastic recycling to be competitive and to create a more circular economy.
Yeah, the guest I mentioned earlier, the chemist.
The polymer chemist.
Polymer chemist from UC Santa Barbara pointed out that The other thing that's very difficult is separating out the various kinds of plastic. And what you end up with if you don't do that separation is a kind of a goo, which is not necessarily suitable for, you know, anything particularly complicated or fancy, like medical equipment and the like.
Correct. Yeah. Right? It'll jam up your recycling stream. So it's really important in a lot of places to not add plastic bags or filamentous plastic to your recycling bin, because it'll jam up that separation process. And it is really important. I encourage all the listeners and you to look at the recycling guidelines for the area where you live and really uphold those guidelines and make sure you're not contaminating that that stream. So figure out what can go in your recycling and try not to add things that'll gum up the system.
Now, I know this is not part of our focus today, but I seem to remember having heard that a lot of recycled plastic, because there's no market for the stuff right now. China, several years ago, it's more than several years ago, basically said it would no longer accept imports of plastics for recycling because there was just too much of it. And so that in some places, the recycled materials are just going back into landfill. Right. So, I mean, there's a big problem.
It's a
there,
huge problem.
Although, you know, it's probably better in landfill than it is thrown into the landscape. One thing, I have heard something like we ingest a credit card's worth of plastic. I can't remember if it's every day or week or what, but is that the case?
Oh my gosh, this is something that comes up all the time.
And that's why I asked.
I'm going to help you debunk it.
Okay.
So this stat is the stat that the average person eats one credit card's worth of plastic a week, which is roughly 5 grams of plastic a week, was debunked. And so this stat came out of a 2021 paper by Sanatha Raja that looked at microplastic concentrations in consumables, so in shellfish and beer and whatnot. And based on those concentrations, they extrapolated it to the average person and in an average week. Well, that line, that comparison to, or that likening to you eat 5 grams, which is one credit card's worth a week, that line was taken and used, was really grabbed onto by the media and used to promote this research. And it just caught like wildfire. So people really started citing it and becoming excited and becoming really nervous about this stat. But it was then reviewed. So this paper was then reviewed. And they found in the review process that that stat was overrepresented by a few orders of magnitude. So the average person, it's likely that the average person does not eat a credit card's worth of plastic a week. It might be possible in some cases, but that was an overestimation. So it's important to note that we likely are ingesting micro and nanoplastics all the time, but I believe it's not to that level.
So how long does it take to ingest a credit card's worth?
I don't know. Do you have your wallet on you? You could give it a try.
Well, if I just eat one, then I've done it, right? It's not quite the same thing. Mattia, maybe in our last few minutes, you could tell us what's your timeline for completing the research and what do you imagine doing with it after you finish?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's something that I'm trying to take day by day. Mm-hmm. I'm learning that science is a really long process. And so it really requires a lot of work day to day in the lab. I'm hoping to start and hopefully finish my chemical exploration of those polymer types pretty soon in the next couple of months. And beyond that, I'm really interested in keeping my fingers on the pulse of microplastic research in the Lake Tahoe Basin. I'm really curious to see what other research comes out of Monica Arienzo's lab and other researchers in the area.
Are you more interested in staying a research scientist or working in policy?
That's a really good question.
That's why I asked.
Sure. Yeah. Let me get back to you after I've completed all my hours and hours and hours of lab work as a bench scientist, and I'll let you know how energized or depleted I am at that point. But I think both sides of that coin are incredibly important. I will add that I met you in the context of science communication in Adina, my PI's science communication class.
Yeah.
And the more that I learned about science communication, the more I see a real passion there. I'm really interested in being able to talk about these things to people to help them understand, especially in this new world of AI, and how when we do Google searches, we really have to be careful and double check what we're getting back. So I think the practice of doing your research and getting really good at reading the material and reading what's out there, and then getting good at communicating that to people and bringing them along with you in that learning journey has been really intriguing to me. And so whatever I end up doing, I'm certainly hoping to continue to refine my communication skills. And I thank you so much for this opportunity to come to the studio, because what a good practice it is to sit down with somebody and to be able to communicate with the folks at home and break these complex problems down into digestible things. So I hope that you and the audience are able to take a few tidbits of information with you from this session.
Well, Mattia Wallner, thank you so much for this interesting interview and for being on Sustainability Now.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You've been listening to Sustainability Now interview with Mattia Wallner, a UC Santa Cruz PhD student in environmental science who is working in Adina Peyton's lab and studying microplastics at the bottom of Lake Tahoe. If you'd like to listen to previous shows, you can find them at ksquid.org/sustainabilitynow, as well as Spotify, YouTube, and Pocket Casts, amongst other podcast sites. So thanks for listening, and thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make K-Squid your community radio station and keep it going. And so happy holidays, and until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Good planets are hard.